Hi, this is Luke Ellott, and welcome to the latest episode of the 7 Investing Podcast. I'm joined for a rather special episode this week by my new colleague and new good friend, Christoph Pikarski. Hi, Christoph.
Hey, good morning, Luke, or good evening.
We're 12 hours apart. I'm currently in Thailand, and I guess you're in Austin, Texas. So it's your 9 a.m., it's 9 p.m.
It is kind of cool looking at the video, seeing my son and your... your moon, the glow.
That's super romantic for our first podcast together. Yeah, right. Christoph, you've invited me for a bit of a special, potentially podcast series, and we're going to perhaps record every 2 weeks. What is it you had in mind, buddy? What are we going to do with this little slot?
I love listening to podcasts and I love listening to business podcasts, but I feel sometimes they get a little too technical or one-dimensional. And the podcasts that I like the most are when I sense rapport between the hosts and a generalist's big view of what's going in the market. So finding a balance between something that's fully scripted and here are all the things we're going to cover and exact sequence we're going to cover. And on the other extreme, maybe like we have no idea what we're going to talk about. Let's just see what happens. Somewhere in the middle feels like there might live a nice balance. So as poker players and as 7 investing colleagues and as runners, I thought, all right, you know, we probably have a lot to talk about. And if we do this every 2 weeks, it'd be a wonderful way for me up from my end to gather information deliberately, knowing, oh, I have to report, you know, I have a conversation with Luke coming up. And so what are the most important things that I learned since we last spoke?
I love the idea and I love the enthusiasm to do something a little bit new. So I'm totally up for it. It terrifies the hell out of me coming to a podcast with a completely blank piece of paper. But you know what? I'm an optimist. And so I think we're going to make this work. And you know what? Actually, I might kick us off there, if you don't mind, with optimism. Because I actually read quite and you know I'm going a little bit on script here, right? I couldn't do no prep. I'll get a bit more comfortable in future fortnights. I read quite a nice article about the power of optimism and it felt quite life affirming. So maybe it is a nice kind of happy place to start off our conversation today because, and even on Slack, right? My little bio is optimist. I've always considered myself an optimist and maybe a bit of a hopeless optimist, but this article on Big Think about a week ago highlighted that actually it's optimism that moves the world forward. And although pessimists can sound super smart and optimists often sound dumb, it's the optimists that make change and make stuff happen. So that made me feel pretty good.
Yeah. The question that comes to mind immediately for me, Luke, about that is, from your perspective, what's the difference between being an optimist and being a Pollyanna, everything's fine? Think positive, you know, the maybe borderline wishful thinking,
right.
How do you see that difference?
All right. So I used to be a program director for a bank. So I used to basically a super project manager, but big global complicated stuff. So you always had to have a plan. You always had to have kind of contingency plans. So life hasn't built me to be kind of blind to all the risks and the things that can go wrong, but at the same time as kind of being aware of all of the bear traps along the journey, I think you've got to strike, set a North Star. If you're going to lead something, lead a change, set a North Star for everybody else and paint. This is, guys, this is what we could do. This is this incredible thing we can create. And so I hope that's my style of optimism, like setting a bit of a vision, but still being realistic, maybe keeping some of the risks and the fears to myself. And if things do go a bit wrong, then I can pull that out of my back pocket and say, okay, we're not lost. This is our new plan. I think you can bring that to investing as well, though. And I know we're not going to exclusively talk about finance stuff on this podcast, but maybe let's try and loop this one back to investing a little bit. I think you can be optimistic as an investor. That's incredibly hard right now, right? Everybody's portfolio is in the toilet, mine included. But optimism helps you kind of stay the course and see the way to the future. But also I think having an optimistic view of the future really gives you that kind of successful growth investor mindset. I know a topic you and I are both very close to and real fans of is AI. And, you know, I think you can take an incredibly optimistic view, rightfully, I suspect, about the wonderful things that AI is going to do for society. And maybe that helps you find investments that you might be afraid of otherwise. What's your thought on that?
Oh, so much there to start with. We're going to need to record every day to get all this stuff. You know, before we get to the AI stuff, something I'm getting to be more and more passionate about trying to understand, I guess, as a little bit of transparency into my background, I've studied the philosophy and framework of Zen now for over a decade, which is, if you take the religious stuff out of it, it's an incredibly powerful framework that attempts to help people stay present and in the moment with things as they are. Meaning there's an idea in there that says most of our problems come from delusional thinking, in which we, through our own cognitive biases or our own previous conditioning, we warp the world and therefore create delusion and a kind of ignorance, and that creates more pain and more bad stuff than is necessary. So what would happen if we sat still more often without a desire to fix and without a desire to alter and just be with what is? And you could see, I think, especially any listeners that have any, I guess, experience or exposure to Stoicism, there's something about a Stoic philosophy that says, let's actually name the difficulties. Let's acknowledge that things will often go poorly, mistakes will be made. And then curiously, out of that kind of philosophy, you realize that when mistakes happen and when things go badly, they're never as bad as you thought. I wonder if when you talk about being an optimist and I talk about maybe the flip side, same coin though, of being true to experience, that if you're skillful enough to walk the delicate balance between the two, you're going to both have that drive that is necessary, that an optimist brings, the desire to move forward, innovate, create, because things can get better, things are good, they're going to get better, we could do lots of positive things, matched with, let's not delude ourselves, right? Let's not call something that is not good, good, simply out of a rah-rah kind of thing. And if you could get that balance just right, that's where amazing things happen.
I like it. I think I am a Stoic, but I'm not sure I could define Stoicism. But let's make this practical though. So could I challenge you to give us, say, you know, my portfolio is in the hole, and I'm sure many of our listeners are in the same boat. So is there a practical lesson from Zen or from Stoicism that we could apply to either help us work through this difficult period, or perhaps to improve our returns as we come back into a growth phase again?
Yeah, I think there is. We tend to run away from difficulty and negative emotions, especially. In one of the more clear cultural ways we do that is via addiction, or multiple addictions of some form. Like, things are bad, right? Therefore, we don't want to be with the bad feelings. Therefore, we have to do something. And typically, that something has to do with some kind of opiate. And whether it's a literal opiate via chemicals or a more metaphorical opiate, call it binge watching TV shows in order to not feel the difficult pain, right? You're still covering.
Dude, did I tell you, I've just rewatched all three seasons of Battlestar Galactica, all four seasons. Okay. I was addicted. I didn't realize.
Well, you know, you might not have been. The watching a lot of TV in quick succession does not mean addiction. It might, but it might not. So I'd ask you, you know, were you watching it to ease the pain of the portfolio being in red, or were you watching it because you love Battlestar Galactica? You know,
maybe more of both than I'd be care to admit. But
okay. So to land this plane, the Zen view during difficult stuff is to turn toward the things that are difficult. And that doesn't mean indulge in them. It means, can you simply be with the upset? Can you be with the sadness? Can you be with the anxiety? Can you be with the whatever thing you're feeling? And I think actually Pixar, that film Pixar In-N-Out, one of my favorite ones. Have you seen that?
I kind of half watched it. I know the premise. Yeah.
I think it does a great job explaining this concept, because the whole plot of that film revolves around the little girl. There's a main character. She's a little girl and she has the trials and tribulations of a young lady. And you get to see inside her mind. And one of the main characters, sadness, her feeling blue, is the one character that's kind of not allowed. She's not allowed by the other emotions to show up. So they try to kind of lock her up, the little character playing sadness. The film is about that mistake, saying sadness not allowed, because sadness does bring something really important, and it's an important quality to our life. So bringing this to the investing stuff, my guess, born from personal experience and what I see happening in the big picture, is when people's portfolios go down as quickly as we've been experiencing, the emotion of anxiety and fear really start to take over, and they end up grabbing the wheel of the bus. And counterintuitively, the more people try to pretend they're not there or sublimate them, the tighter the grip gets. And then bad actions come from, it's all the behavioral stuff. Then there's all kinds of trading, panic selling. It's like that force and counterforce, right? The more you deny your fear, the larger it's going to get. The more you repress stuff, it's going to just pop out in different ways. So what would happen if you try to befriend the fear? And that's that, maybe that little bit of the optimist stuff you were talking about, Luke, that if you're an optimist in that kind of maybe pure way, then you're going to see things in maybe like that some good could come out of this. So, okay, we have fear here. We have a whole bunch of fear. Things are not great, but I don't have to be afraid of the fear. So what would happen if I actually befriended it and say, oh, you're doing something for me. You're really scared that X, Y, and Z. You want to talk about it. And you could actually, as per the Pixar movie, I promise you're not going to be carted off to the loony bin if you actually think, let me talk to my fear. Let me talk to the part of me that's afraid.
I don't want to turn into Smeagol and Gollum, but yeah, maybe having a quiet conversation with myself. I get the power of that.
Yeah, that's right. Go on a run and talk to yourself on your run.
So you've just been on a run this morning, and you're right. We're both runners. I loved listening to podcasts when I'm running, and you know, maybe a bunch of our listeners are out on foot today. What do you normally listen to? What do you enjoy most out of a podcast when you're running around?
Well, since we're really going deep here, Luke. Let me tell you that I used to make fun of people who listen to stuff while running, because for the longest time, running was a serious, like, intense thing for me. And so I needed to hear my own breath. I needed to get in tune with my body. Music, sound, all of that was one, a distraction, terrible distraction. Two, I could never hear all the pretty ladies whistling at me as I was going by, which was a tremendous loss. So it's only when I started the zone two training stuff, which is, there's a bunch of physiology research that says in order to really become faster, most of your runs have to be done really, really, really slow, which for me was like, I couldn't do it. It was such a pain in the ass for me. Like, I was like, my God, I really can't tolerate the slow pace. Got through that phase, and podcasts helped me do that, because I started thinking, I'm not really go running here. I'm just going on this little waddle thing, and what's going to pass the time? Listen to great podcasts. So for quite a while, I've gotten immense value from the Tim Ferriss podcast. I don't know if you're familiar with that one.
I am. Yeah. I haven't listened to too many. I think his personality grates me a little bit personally, but I've got a lot of friends who get a lot out of what he has to say.
Yeah, that's so interesting, because maybe because I've been following him for quite a number of years. And then, of course, he moved to Austin, Texas, and his big book reveal from the 4-hour work week was kind of happened during South by Southwest. I find him increasingly humble and good intentioned. And there was one big podcast he did recently. I don't know if you know about it, where he revealed all his childhood abuse trauma and he released it publicly. That to me, I think takes an immense amount of courage to really talk about the darkest stuff in your life it's one of the top podcasts in the world for many years. So, you know, it wasn't just a couple of listeners. And I thought when I heard that, this guy's really serious about trying to offer value and good and to do good in the world. You don't take that path, especially on the business focused podcast. I mean, his entrepreneurship, that's kind of where it started. You know, like the theme of the show is him talking to experts in a certain field and trying to figure out their routines and like, what is it that they do that made them so good at their field? Well, over the years, and he actually talked about this too, quite explicitly in this kind of meta way with one of his guests saying, I think I'm afraid that I'm leaving my listenership behind because I started as this business oriented podcast. But now I realize that a great value that I try to offer my listenership has to do with internal work, has to do with a kind of internal engineering. And therefore, if I'm going to do that, I have to talk about my dark stuff, my dark clouds.
That's cool. I've misjudged the guy. I'll be fair. Like I haven't listened to him for years, so I'm definitely going to give it another go.
Yeah. Maybe next time I'll come back with some greatest hits.
Yeah. Fantastic. I'm sure our listeners would appreciate great. That too.
So what about you, Luke? Is there a podcast that you really enjoy?
Like a bunch of regular finance ones. There's a couple that we're, I guess, affiliated with. I really like the guys at Chit Chat Money. I think they do a really good job. I don't know that they're sharing childhood trauma, but they just have a really insightful conversation about companies I'm interested in. There's a guy called Lex Friedman. Not sure if you've heard of him. Fantastic interviewer, super smart Russian-American dude. And he has just some of the most incredible minds on his show. So I listen to pretty much all of those. And he's a big AI guy. And, you know, he's always asking about, are we living in a simulation? It's become his standard question now. So I quite enjoy that. And then I guess I'm probably more close to US politics than UK politics. So the other one that gets a regular listen for me is the All In Pod. They have a good chat. They challenge each other. They talk about interesting stuff and they're poker players. So it hits a lot of my buttons.
That's so interesting to me. Why do you think you're more US centric versus UK centric?
Have you seen what's happening in the UK?
Well, first condolences.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. Thank you. Yes. On behalf of the nation. Thank you. An incredible lady and an incredible stoic, I guess, the queen. An incredible person and she's had an amazing life. But if we put the loss of the Queen aside, the country isn't in a great place right now. I wasn't a fan of Brexit. I think we're now seeing the unraveling that results from that. I see the pound nearly hit parity with the dollar yesterday. That's quite exciting. So things aren't going in a good direction. For total transparency, I got my Irish citizenship about 6 weeks ago. So my Irish passport's on the way. I'm going to be Brexit immune personally, but I feel sorry for the rest of my countrymen and women who haven't got the same biological luck.
Do you mind talking about how you got the Irish passport?
It's not terribly exciting. My dad's mother was born in Northern Ireland. I had no idea that Northern Ireland was good enough, apparently, because Northern Ireland is part of the UK, whereas the Republic of Ireland, the sort of south bit, that's been part of Europe for a long time and has the euro. But apparently if you're born on the island of Ireland, that's good enough. And so if you have a grandparent who was born there, you can get on the foreign birth registry. So my brother and I did that last month.
Well, that's an interesting case that you focus on US politics because the UK is a mess.
Well, also it's more relevant to my investments. Like my portfolio is 90 99% US equities. So actually, the pound being decimated is actually quite good for me personally. It's held up a lot of the losses of the last month or two, but you know, net, that's still not a great thing. I own property in the UK. It's not good, big picture.
Yeah. Well, I'm a fan of your little island.
Have you visited?
I did. I visited and had, when I was working on my dissertation, which is in the field of English literature. Mm-hmm. So one of the first places I went to around London was Samuel Johnson House. Mm-hmm. He's the one who more or less created the first English dictionary, among other works of literature. And I lived in Brighton with a friend for about 8 weeks.
Right.
And I took my morning runs all along the pier. And I had a really amazing, I think it was a week long sojourn to the Cotswolds. Mm. What a gorgeous, gorgeous part of the country.
Certainly is.
And I ate a bunch of, what is it? There's some kind of pies. That region is known for some sort of custards or pies or some special name for them.
Yeah, I know exactly what you're referring to. My Hong Kong buddy's a huge fan of them. The name eludes me for a moment, but yeah, some kind of meat pie with pastry. It's not very good for you. It's certainly not going to help you with your running times. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So the image I have of the UK, at least the parts I went to, is this bucolic rolling green fields and llamas and botanical gardens and these delicious custard things. So big, big fans.
Pretty good. But I try and spend a month or two in the US every year too. I'm a huge fan of skiing and snowboarding. So I'm planning to come out there this winter to get a taste of Lake Tahoe and the mountains.
Speaking of geographical locations far and wide, you're in Taiwan now.
Thailand. In fact, in Koh Samui.
Oh, I'm sorry, Thailand.
An island about an hour south of Bangkok. Yep.
And what brings you there?
I came out with a buddy, Tom, and we came to play poker in Phnom Penh in Cambodia. But we could only fly in and out of Bangkok, so we kind of put a kind of multi-stop destination together. And then Tom flew home 3 days ago, and my wife kind of tag-teamed him and arrived. So we had a pretty, we did nothing touristy. We literally played poker from morning till night for about 7 days Cambodia. And then my wife's here now. I'm trying to reset the balance. So actually, I've got a bit of heat stroke because I haven't really caught the sun because I've been in a dark, gloomy poker room, and I was out there a little too long this morning, so I'm looking a little bit red.
Mm-hmm.
Might be able to tell.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
I've been listening to a lot of poker podcasts, or rather guests on Lex Fridman and Tim Ferriss.
Yeah. So. He had Liv Bari a couple of weeks ago, I think. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I've played with Liv.
That's right.
And she used to play in a poker club I was a regular at way, way back. Yeah. She wouldn't remember.
Oh, sure.
We played a few times together. She was really good fun. She was just learning to play poker then. It's before she made stardom. But she was a good player.
Right, yeah. Yeah, what a fascinating, fascinating world that is. Yeah. We could talk about it forever, too. Is there anything you'd want to say about your experience?
I do think there are, I haven't kind of cleared the topic with Simon just yet, but I personally think there are massive skill overlaps between the discipline of playing poker well, you know, not playing like a drunken buffoon, and being a good investor. So actually, I've been trying to get Phil Galfond onto the 7 Investing podcast. So I'm going to go and chase that again in a month or two's time. I think I could do justice to the topic, but it'd be great to get a world-class player like Phil on to give us his business poker perspective.
I imagine, Luke, that this could be a recurring theme because it seems, I mean, maybe you're on the world tour, so... Last time I played seriously was many years ago, grad school. My poker origin story, though, is quite good. So, but that's a long, maybe we could save that for another time. But I think because of the analogs between investing and poker, I wouldn't want it to be a one-off conversation,
mm-hmm.
right? Because, for example, one obvious thing to me is thinking in probabilities and not just probabilities, but knowing, acknowledging upfront that you will never, ever fully know all the things you would like to know. And so how does that, for example, affect me as an investor? Well, I start to get a little, I have an allergic reaction to things like price targets or like long-term dollar discount, cash discounted flows, not because the, I mean, there's different levels of skill involved, but when you start from the other end that you simply don't know and can't ever know how something is going to come out, trying to become meticulous to the decimal point about the value of something. And actually maybe that's not the mistake I see. That's all fine. That's part of a process. But then to start doubling down on the conviction stuff, like I'm certain, like certainty is a slippery slope. And once you do all this work, right, putting in a bunch of numbers, you start convincing yourself, I know how this is going to turn out. And if one thing poker tells, beats you down with over and over again, right, is until after the river card has fallen and until everything is revealed, you just don't know.
You got it. That's a great lesson. And I agree, one of the most important things, and you can apply that to everything, not just investing, right? Nothing in life is black and white. And you fool yourself. You're setting yourself up for a nasty surprise when a low probability outcome comes to pass. Hey, you say you haven't played poker for a while though. I seem to recall from Slack just in the last few hours, you have a trophy from a poker tournament you may have played this weekend. What's that all about?
indeed. My days, Luke, as a bachelor are quickly coming to an end.
Congratulations.
So thank you. So the fellas got together on a lake house here in Austin and we played a poker tournament, the prize of which were, in descending order of quality, different bottles of alcohol. And I actually won. I flopped a straight, Luke. And turns out someone else at the table also flopped a straight, was one of those really unfortunate.
Who had the bus straight?
He had the ace high straight. Okay. So I busted out and won a third place fine bottle of Austin Still Bourbon, which is a local bourbon, and it's stunningly done well in blind taste tests here in Austin.
Congratulations. So an admirable third. Very good.
When you flop a straight, you know, like, and you lose, you know, like, what are you going to do?
I like that you, I asked you about your poker tournament. You managed to get a bad beat story in. That's a sign of a poker player.
Technically, it wasn't a bad beat. Technically, that's just the tragic outcome, right? there's, I think, a difference. Because, you know, the guy flopped the ace high straight, so it's not, you know, there was no...
You can get away from that in the World Series, but maybe not at Lake House at the end of a drunken bachelor weekend.
Yeah, exactly. So there's, a lot of poker books I've benefited reading helped me as an investor. So maybe we could talk about some of those in the future.
Love to. I've got a whole bookshelf at home behind me, which is exclusively poker books. Mm-hmm. Happy to pick up any of those.
Me too.
We should talk books on a future podcast as well, because I think that's a point of difference between the two of us. Like I read for pleasure, but I rarely read to educate myself, but I know you do. And I'd be keen to understand your process there, because I find finance books a bit of a yawn-a-thon.
Yeah, maybe explicit finance books. But the stuff we've been talking about, it seems to me, like, for example, a pretty famous poker book, Thinking in Bets, that does not feel to me like I'm reading a hardcore, you know, eat your veggies kind of book. I feel like, okay, I know I'm going to learn a lot from this. A book, Annie Duke, a serious poker player that now is a consultant in terms of thinking process. So when I read that, I find it quite enjoyable. Maybe not as enjoyable as, say, Lord of the Rings or or Dune, you know, but whereas, yeah, straight up finance books, like reading financial statements, yeah, that's a little harder to swallow.
Hey, you know, just to jump in, actually, I wonder if now is a good time to give a shout out to one of the sponsors of the show. Christoph, let's just take a moment to consider the times we're in. The current economic climate has people wondering, when will it ever end? Record high gas prices, volatility in the market, inflation, ongoing disruptions in the supply chain. Luckily, investors, you have Zacks Investment Research, which provides in-depth financial data and expert analysis to help you make more strategic investment decisions. The Fed's doing all it can to cool down inflation, and stocks have already started to respond. And when the market's gripped in pessimism, Zacks provides the invaluable resources investors need to capitalize on volatility and buy stocks when they're low. They'll also help you spot losers, so you know which stocks to avoid or eliminate from your portfolio. Experts know market volatility unearths great opportunities. Current conditions have done just that. To provide value to our listeners, Zacks is providing the opportunity to download their report, 5 Stocks Set to Double, absolutely free and with no obligation. The Zacks experts are revealing their top 5 stocks with the best chance of gaining 100% or more over the next 12 months. Imagine how that could affect your portfolio or retirement savings. Fight inflation and download your free report today. That's www.zacks.com/7investingpodcast. Christoph, what do you make of that? Are you going to go check out that Zacks report?
Amen, brother.
I'm very much up for 5 product. Stocks that will double over the next year. I'll take 5 stocks that won't halve over the next year.
I started investing in 1995, so I was 16.
Very good. That definitely deserves commendation. I was late to the party. That's incredible.
Yeah, thank you. But I mentioned that, Luke, because as far as I could tell, now in hindsight, I've never had to live through this kind of inflationary period, one. But I think, I'm not sure, based on my current understanding, I'm not sure if any investor has had this kind of particular cocktail of stuff that we do now. And so it's interesting, speaking of volatility, you know, we always make analogies and try to figure out, well, this is what happened before, so this is what we can expect now. I wondered to what extent going forward, the clear analogies stay tethered to previous errors versus it looks like a duck, it walks like a duck, but is it really going to quack in the end? I don't know. I really don't know. Wonder if you have any prognostications.
Yeah. So I suppose what the question is, have the last 20 years been a bit of a delusion and now we're back to the toil and, you know, not seeing the hypergrowth that we've had in the past, well, in recent 2 decades, or has this reset been a reset, but we're going to be back on that trajectory? So kind of the optimist in me says the latter, and the realist in me too, actually, because, okay, hold me to account on this. If you don't, I think you're probably going to buy my argument, but hold me to account on this, play devil's advocate, right? Just the ever increasing, the ever accelerating pace of innovation. It took a long time, as we all know, to work our way up through like the industrial age and then the age of like steamships and railways. And the world is just a very different place now. And, you know, it's not just Moore's law talking about processing capability at cost, right? You could apply that thinking of Moore's law to almost anything. The world is changing at an increasingly fast rate. So do we ever get back to kind of boring times where your portfolio might run 2 or 3 years and gain, you know, 3 or 4% a year? I don't think we do. I think we're probably living in volatile times. There's some crazy stuff going on right now, and it could get a lot worse if we're realistic about kind of what's happening in Ukraine. But if we all, frankly, if we all live through this period, right, all of these impacts feel somewhat transitory to me. We're basically past the pandemic, barring one or two countries, where supply chain woes are kind of in the rear view mirror. We need to see how the situation with Taiwan kind of shakes out and the US and China. But I'm hoping, well, you know, again, it's another one of those, do we end up in kind of destruction of the planet because it's US versus China or US versus Russia? If we can avoid kind of blowing ourselves up, then I do optimistically/realistically feel like we do get back to crazy growth mode, and there will be some incredible innovations that none of us could possibly predict coming over the next 10 years. They're going to drive, you know, many, many companies to a $1 trillion valuation and some to, you know, the first $10 trillion company, frankly, it's probably going to be something like SpaceX or Google.
You've given me a hard task there because I'm in alignment with you. So playing devil's advocate would be, in this case, would feel disingenuous to me.
Sure.
Of course, things can get worse.
Right.
And maybe the duration of how bad things are, maybe it's longer than we'd like to admit. So I'll grant that. But given the exponential rise of technology and speed of innovation, I think what you said is exactly right. Like we're solving some of the biggest problems that humanity has ever had.
Mm-hmm.
And it's all happening now. As one example, and maybe this is a nice segue to talk about the one agenda item I had, which is a little bit of maybe intro to AI. Recently, I think it was in July of this year, it was announced that the AI program AlphaGo had more or less solved protein structure, and that this database was being made public, available to all biologists.
Yep. AlphaFold.
So
was that particular
AlphaFold? I'm sorry.
Yep.
AlphaFold. Right.
Yep.
That's right. Protein structure determines the drugs that are made to cure our worst diseases. That's been the, to a large extent, the problem. You know, can we figure out which protein via and what its structure is? It used to take years. So now all this stuff is known. So if you're invested in anything having to do with biopharm, biotech, it's hard to be, given this recent innovation, it's hard for me to hold on to a pessimistic view that this, whatever macro is doing, how can you earnestly believe that in the next 3 to 5 years, the pace and the extent of the cures that we're going to find is somehow going to be either stay the same or drop? I don't find that a tenable argument.
Yeah, I agree. Is this,
and that's just, you know, in one field. Yeah.
Yeah.
So the thing that I wanted to talk about a little bit is this notion of optimism and pessimism in the context of AI. And one of the things I'd like to share is some of the learnings I've had from this book. It's called Artificial Intelligence, A Guide for Thinking Humans by Melanie Mitchell. For us viewers, this is the book. And there's a full chapter in here dedicated to, I did not know this, the winter and spring of AI, that this has been a cycle since, correct me if I'm wrong, if you know, I think the origins of AI investigation and thinking happened sometime around the 60s or maybe 70s.
Yep.
So that's about 50 years now. And it turns out even way back then, before we even had anywhere near the compute power as we do today, there has been this war between the optimists saying AI is coming and it's coming soon, and the, call it, pessimists who say it's not a thing that humans could solve. And then this back and forth has continued to cycle through decades. It turns out, as far as I could tell, that now in 2022, we're in a period of AI optimism again. AI spring, as she references it, that AI, no, really this time it is different, right? And I've been sitting with this question because on the one hand, I could completely see the argument, the overzealous, overly optimistic argument. Okay, look, we've been saying the same thing now for 50 years. We still haven't solved true AI intelligence, which we ought to define, maybe later. It's a little bit technical, but for now, you know, there's like claim being, we won't ever really get true thinking machines. That's the knock against AI. But in 2022, as what I was saying with regard to AlphaFold, that's a tremendous innovation. And no, it's not true AI, but does it need to be when it's going to solve all these problems?
Yeah. I think sort of tighten up the distinctions a little bit, I guess you're talking there about kind of like a narrow AI that can solve a problem. And I totally agree, right? Now we're solving real problems in all fields with narrow AI. But then this other thing is like AGI, artificial general intelligence. And, you know, who knows how far away that is. But you know, you don't need AGI to make the world materially better with narrow AI.
That's right. Yeah. And maybe the most obvious use case now for me is the Tesla FSD full self-driving beta program, which I've been using now for, is it 6 months, maybe longer? During that bachelor party, two of my buddies got in the car and they wanted to see, you know, they had never experienced it. So we drove a few miles and yeah, it stopped at a stop sign and it made an unprotected left turn without any input from me. And that's 2022. Mm-hmm. So on the one hand, to bring this back, It's so odd, this phrase, this time it is different. Given the data that for 50 years, people have been saying that they've been wrong every single time. So for us now, during this era of AI spring, say no, but this time really it is different. It feels, I wonder 10 years from now, when we listen to this conversation, how we'll see this. But I see a clear case that goes beyond wishful thinking. The proof points now are visible to me for why it is different this time.
Yeah.
And then if that's the case, then being an optimist, to take us full circle, is going to pay tremendous dividends if you could clearly identify the real stuff from the rah-rah hoopla stuff.
Very good. I think you've done a great job there of kind of bookending our conversation. You've taken us from optimism to AI and the future of humanity, and you've managed to join them together. I like it.
I like it too, Luke.
Let's hope it is an optimistic future. Because I guess there are some pessimistic outcomes when we hit the singularity and artificial and general intelligence is here. And, you know, perhaps the happy outcome is we become pets of a benevolent AI dictatorship. But there are certainly some bad outcomes, depending on the objective function that the goals that the AI has set for itself. So, you know, I wonder if that could be the end of humanity. I'm curious to find out.
Well, you know, I mean, that's a big leap. And I'll add this, that I have one brand new takeaway from this book. This is, by the way, the author is a professor and a lifelong AI investigator. So this is not not coming from the peanut gallery. Her fundamental claim is that real AI, I mean, it depends on real, meaning strong, meaning the AIG stuff, the general intelligence, depends on understanding, meaning itself, that it's not until there's a self-reflective quality can you really call it artificial intelligence in that general sense? And from her point of view, we are really, really, really far away. Despite all the advances in narrow AI, there are still experts in this field that say we're just not going to get there. It doesn't matter how many chess championships will go or protein folding simulations will accomplish. That's still, none of those entail true understanding of what's happening, and that the leap, the bridge, is still so immense that the fear of the stuff you were talking about, the dystopian and meeting our future overlords and all that, it's decades away, according to this view.
It's a way away, but I think whether it's decades, would you like a poker player bet with me on this then? So I would wager that let's split the difference on decades. Say in the next 15 years, we could be joined on the podcast by an artificial human, and that would be among our most scintillating guests to talk about pretty much any topic we could think of. Hey, actually, that reminds me, I sent you some fun stuff, yeah, didn't I, in Slack the other day? I've forgotten about that. The natural language AI thing. That was pretty cool.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. Oh, I had such a good time reading that. That was fascinating. You just described the Turing test.
I guess. I think there's lots of muddy definitions of the Turing test now, but yeah, you're right. That is, yeah, essentially that's the essence of it, isn't it?
Yeah. Which might be, for listeners not familiar with this, it seems like one of the major, what is it, not barriers, maybe thresholds that we're looking to pass is if there was a voice, say, behind a curtain, and you spoke to this voice for an extended period of time with the goal of trying to figure out whether this voice is a human or an artificial intelligence, and you could speak about whatever you want and ask whatever you want, could you tell the difference? And if you couldn't, then we've reached this general level of intelligence. And I think your bet is saying in 15 years, right? So that if we had one of these guests, then assumingly it would be as good a kind of form of intelligence as us, right?
I'd argue far superior, probably. But
first, oh, yeah,
and you'd probably right, probably fail right. the Turing test because it was such an erudite, educated guest about on any topic.
Right, we're right.
Yeah, yeah. You're too damn smart.
Right. So you were saying 2015, right? I'm sorry, no, not 2015.
Years.
You were saying 15 years. So that would be 2037.
I'll stick it in my diary, Christoph, if we're still recording
yeah, podcasts
then. 2037? You fancy that bet?
Isn't there, what's the Kurt W, what's his name?
Ray Kurzweil.
The singularity guy.
Ray Kurzweil.
Yes.
Yeah.
Was it his initial, time frame 2049?
I just listened to him on the podcast with Lex the other day. Yeah. Last week I listened to him. He set a date. I think he set like, was it 2040? I think it may have been like in 40 years, but that was like 20 years ago. So I feel like 2037 isn't a million miles away from his estimate.
That's right. The Turing test, I think he's saying 2029.
Okay.
So that's 7 years away.
Right.
But I think the whole singularity
bit,
2049 seems to be the date.
Okay.
So you're suggesting 2037.
Let me read an excerpt from the little fun thing I sent you on Slack the other day. Almost. So I was chatting to a couple of characters, but one of them was Elon Musk, AI Elon Musk. And I had a pretty compelling conversation with Elon, right? Unprompted, let me just read an excerpt from this. And he hasn't passed the Turing test, but I think it's pretty smart. Elon says, "Hey, Luke, what would you like to discuss? Hi, Elon. When will full self-driving be ready? No more than 6 months from now, I hope. I actually took an experimental version to LA today for a few hours to show some of our partners. It's looking quite good and is improving exponentially. Elon, I'm really excited for it. My Tesla isn't that smart yet. To the point about how smart your Tesla is, this is one of the biggest breakthroughs in artificial intelligence. The notion of onboard. We need to evolve the intelligence of your car by having it train every night against the fleet of all Teslas in the world in a highly automated fashion. Elon, will my car go into battle with other Teslas? They will compete in a friendly match to ensure they don't crash into each other, to see how well they've absorbed the experience of driving around the world. The more they experience, the better they will perform." The conversation goes on, but Elon is clearly understanding what the hell I'm talking about.
Yeah, I wonder what the, and we're talking about Elon time, right? So he's still using his 6 months from now. So if we translate that to real time, that's a year and 6 months from now. Yeah, but no, I that was so fascinating. What do you remember what the actual website is so people could go to it? It's like character.ai, right? Or
something like that. Yeah, we will stick it in the show notes because it was super fun. Beta.character.ai. Go play with it. It's free to sign up and they've got hundreds of bots to talk about pretty much any conversation you'd like to have. I had a bunch of fun ones with it. It's good fun.
That's right. So the interface is you go to this website and you see a page that has icons of, say, Elon and who were you having a conversation with regarding the platypus and monkey?
That was who would win? So who would win? He says to me, "Luke, you name literally
who's the character?" But
the character was who would win. That's the name of the character, and he will He will have a battle with you over any two things, real or imaginary. So yeah, I had a thought battle with who would win between monkeys and platypi.
It was so good.
Yeah,
it was so good. And maybe last thing to add to today's episode, just what was it, 4 days ago, or maybe this weekend, within this past week anyway, there's a new big AI development called Open Whisper. Did you come across this?
I did not.
I believe it's an open platform available to all developers. There's a technical barrier to installing it in your own computer, so it's not quite ready yet for technology noobs. But Open Whisper is an AI program that translates human voice, basically completes the translation task at a level exceeding human capacity. And I listened to some of these samples. So there was one that was kind of like the voice of a auction bidder, you know, how fast they talk, like deliberately fast. And it got every single word, translated accents and foreign languages. And I mean, you name it. And the translation was just so spot on. It's kind of making the ripple. It's kind of sending ripples in the AI world. But this is exactly to bring this back home one more time. This is an example of narrow AI, where if you throw enough data at a thing and you're smart about how the data is organized and processed, it seems AI could solve so many problems.
Yeah.
But it's not the general intelligence stuff.
Right.
So just to make sure that's clear.
But you've hit on the key point there, right? It doesn't need to be the AGI to add value. And I think taking like narrow AI or AIs and augmenting a human being or a team with those, suddenly you get kind of exponential capabilities, you know, just helping us all be better at the stuff we want to do and have to do, because we've got these AI assistants helping us with, you know, kind of mundane tasks. That's where the acceleration comes from. That's, you know, if we bring it all the way back to finance, because it is, I guess, supposed to be a finance podcast, you know, that's where some of the really big companies of the future are going to be born from, where they're, you know, helping us all just be more efficient, get more out of our day.
Right. And in all my recommendations for 7 Investing, I've made it my mission to include an AI checkbox quality. Like, to what extent can this company benefit from narrow AI even today? And
like it.
Yeah, and my recommendation for October seems, as a little bit of a teaser, seems primed perfectly for this kind of problem. It's like, and so when I see that, I get excited. It's just going to be that much more quick, powerful, and solve so many more problems on a scale and speed and level of efficiency that we're just not familiar with. So it gives me a little bit of maybe that safety of margin, like, if it has AI, if it's sort of primed to benefit from AI, I'm like, okay, I'm definitely looking in that direction. If it doesn't, then I get worried, or maybe not worried. I get less confident, because then it's just going to, that business just won't benefit from this huge, huge thing. So why would I recommend it? It's my new framework.
It's good. So it's good to make it an objective thing you think about. I don't do that, but maybe I should. I like it. And I do like your October stock recommendation. It's one I've owned for a few months. I think it's not very widely known out there. So good to have a new name on the 7 Investing scorecard. I'm really excited to see where this one goes.
Me too. Luke, what do you think? How'd we do?
I think we did pretty good. I enjoyed our chat today. I'll apologize for muting myself on and off, because I'm just coughing away like a lunatic. I spent a hard couple of weeks at the poker table. But I can feel
hard living,
yeah,
right?
Hard living.
The poker life. See, we could talk forever, but one of the things that people maybe don't understand about poker, which is similar to chess in this way, that if you're a high level chess player, you have to be in exquisite physical condition. That people train, like they go, good chess players go to the weight room and they do their cardio. Because your brain uses more energy than any other organ. So if you're sitting there thinking nonstop, you're really going to deplete yourself, and you need to be strong. And if you've ever played any amount of poker in your life, right, when you're sitting at that table, it's like a marathon.
You got it. You've reminded me where my game fell down then in Phnom Penh, because it didn't go very well. And it's probably my not being a finely tuned instrument. I'm coughing again. There's the evidence of that. Well, hey, look, I think we should round this out with a congratulations to you two on your impending nuptials. Is the big day coming up soon?
October 15th.
Wow.
So maybe the next time we record, that will be my last podcast in the bachelorhood state.
Fantastic. Well, I'll think of an agenda topic related to that.
Cool. Awesome, Luke. It was great doing this first podcast with you. Hopefully it's something we continue and we'll see if folks dig it. So
I digged it if nobody else did, but I think we'll find some fans out there. Thanks, Christoph. Great chatting today.
All right, Luke. Take care of yourself. Speak soon.
A reminder that people on this program may hold positions in the companies that are mentioned. Buying and selling stock carries financial risk, which could include the loss of capital. The views in this program should not be taken as personalized advice. Before acting on any of the information provided, listeners are encouraged to consult a financial or tax professional.